Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, we are off to Mars in a mini. Well, almost.
The thrusters will push against the gravitational pull of Mars until it hovers maybe 20 meters or so above the surface, and then it reels the rover out on a set of cables down to the surface of the planet.
That's NASA's John Grotzinger, the chief scientist behind the Curiosity Mars rover mission, which blasts off to the red planet later this month. We'll hear from him how you get a car-sized rover down in one piece, and the chemistry it's destined to do later in the programme. Hello, I'm Chris Smith. Welcome to the November 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. Also with me this month are Philip Broadwith, Laura Howes and Patrick Walter, and they'll be talking about the creation of the world's longest chemical bond and the world's slipperiest substance. Plus, it's your chance to brush up on what a quasicrystal is when we take a look at this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick us off, in the world of chemical bonds, size and certainly length are definitely important. Phil.
Absolutely, Chris. And one of the things that a lot of chemists are trying to do is trying to make the longest bonds they possibly can to test out the limits of, you know, how strongly atoms are held together and how they can design molecules that have particular shapes or particularly strained and weak bonds that might be particularly reactive in different ways or things like that.
Indeed. So what have they done here?
This group, led by Peter Schreiner at Justus Liebig University in Germany, has made what they're claiming is the longest carbon-carbon bond in an alkane. It's 1.7 angstroms long, which is a little bit longer than a normal sort of carbon-carbon bond, average at about 1.5 angstroms. So it's a little bit longer.
So how have they actually done this? Because my understanding is that when you actually bond something together covalently, like a hydrocarbon, it's because the clouds of electrons from one atom interact with the clouds of electrons from the second atom, and you bring about a bond. So how can you manipulate the length of that?
Okay, Chris, well, that interaction is the same, but that's if you're just talking about those two atoms. What chemists generally do to try and elongate these bonds is to attach other stuff to those two atoms that they're trying to bond. So if you attach great big bulky groups to those two atoms, you get like a dumbbell-shaped molecule. So the carbon-carbon bond is the bar of the dumbbell, and you've got this other bulky stuff attached to the carbons on either end.
And those two big bulky things repel each other, and that pushes the bond apart.
Yeah, so the bulky stuff on either end literally just pushes the bond apart and puts strain on that bonding interaction, which just holds the carbon atoms just a little bit further apart, far enough apart that they can still just about interact and make a bond, but that bond is much weaker.
Now, you mentioned that there could be some use in understanding this kind of thing because you know that you could use this sort of chemistry to create bits of molecules that are a bit more vulnerable to that bond breaking than another region or something. Are there any ways in which this could immediately be exploited or applied then?
Probably not directly, but the interesting thing about this particular work is that basically, to make these kind of long bonds stable, you need not just a repulsion, but some kind of attractive force to balance that out just enough to keep the bond together. And what Schreiner and his group have done is use van der Waals interactions. So the big bulky molecules that they've got on either end of their carbon-carbon bond have relatively flat faces that are covered in hydrogen, and they have just enough van der Waals attraction between them to keep the bond together. So using that principle, you could think about designing other molecules or using it to stabilise different kinds of molecules and materials.
Thank you, Phil. No flies on him. We're talking of flies. Tell us about this pitcher plant-inspired slippery stuff, Patrick. Apparently the most slippery substance known to man, apart from Tony Blair, has been invented.
Okay, so Joanna Eisenberg's group at Harvard University were looking at new ways to develop omniphobic materials. So these are materials that repel both liquids like water and also organic liquids like oils.
Have we not already got super slippery substances? I mean, what's Teflon then?
Yeah, Teflon is a super slippery substance, but it's kind of different to the other kind of nano-engineered approaches they've been looking at. So people have been looking at super hydrophobic slippery surfaces based on the lotus leaf. So the lotus effect is based on miniature papillae that sit on top of the lotus leaf, and that when something like water rests on the lotus leaf, the small pockets of air trapped beneath the water droplets. So this creates nice round droplets that just roll straight off. But this doesn't work for oils because oils do not have the surface tension that water does. So they just collapse. So they wet the leaf.
Sure, they're just going to get underneath the air.
Exactly,
and
yes.
Displace the air out.
So what Joanna Eisenberg has done is she's tried to copy the pitcher plants. So pitcher plants are plants that grow throughout Southeast Asia. These plants have a bulb which is filled with a digestive fluid. And when insects land on top of the opening of this bulb, they just simply slip off and fall in. So they started looking into why this happens and they wanted to copy it.
Why does it happen?
So what's special about the pitcher plant is around the top of this bulb where the insects tend to meet their rather unpleasant end is that there's these small nano-sized pillars kind of sticking out from the plant surface, and this is coated in a kind of nectar. So this means that when the flies land on it, the oils don't grip, they just slip straight off it.
Oh, because the fly's foot is oily. You've got this watery layer on the surface of the plant. Oil and water won't mix, so you've got fluid on fluid, and it's slippery.
So oil and water are immiscible, they're not going to mix, and this creates the slipperiness.
Now, obviously, they're not going to reinvent the wheel and make another pitcher plant. So what did this Harvard group do?
They had two different approaches. One approach was to create small nanopillars, a bit like many of the super hydrophobic materials that have gone in the past, and then a completely unstructured Teflon surface made with just a complete mixture of Teflon fibres. And then what they did, copying the pitcher plant with its nectar liquid, they used a fluorinated compound. So they just soaked this structure with it. And this creates a slippery surface. So things like oils can't interact with this fluorinated compound, and neither can water. It's immiscible with both. So anything that lands on it, they tested things like jam, ants.
It's a liquid. It's not a gas. With the lotus leaf, you've got air. Mm. It's a gas. It's compressible and displaceable. Whereas if you have a liquid there, it won't get compressed, will it?
So exactly. So what's very important?
This thing will work under very interesting conditions.
Yeah, this is very useful because it can work under high pressures, things like oil pipelines perhaps. It's self-healing. So it just keeps recovering if it gets knocked.
Something I think we wish we could all do. Thank you, Patrick. Mars is the focus of the Space Science Fraternity's attention this month when Curiosity, a new rover mission, blasts off on November the 25th. NASA's John Grotzinger is the chief scientist on the project.
The Curiosity rover differs from that of previous missions in that it has a very involved set of instruments, the most complex set that's ever been flown to the surface of another planet. And between those instruments, we should be able to make a variety of measurements and integrate the measurements that are made to create a new insight into the habitability of ancient environments on Mars, as well as get a sense for the current surface environments of Mars.
First of all, how big is Curiosity?
Curiosity weighs 899.2 kilograms. It's about the size of a Mini Cooper.
Wow, that's pretty big. Is that not what an order of magnitude, larger than the ones that are down there at the moment?
It's about half an order of magnitude. Spirit and Opportunity each weighed about 180 kilograms, and with Curiosity weighing in at 900, it's a very significant increase in the mass of the rover.
And size too. So what are you going to pack into this Mini Cooper-sized frame? What will go in there, and why are we scaling up to this ginormous size?
The reason for the increase in the size is because we have two instruments that function within the internal environment of the rover. So they're sort of in the belly of the beast, if you will. And when we collect samples, we do it by drilling, and we need a kind of a drill that's able to penetrate into rocks up to depths of about 5 centimeters. The drill bit's about a centimeter and a half in diameter, and then it feeds these powders through a very complex labyrinth of processing elements so that it comes out, the sample is sieved down to about 150 microns, and then it goes inside the rover And in there, we have these two very specialized instruments. So that's what results really in the increase in the mass.
What sorts of rocks are you going to be drilling into? What are you looking for?
Well, we've chosen a landing site that sits quite near the equator of Mars, but near a feature called the dichotomy boundary, where Mars basically gets cleft into two different hemispheres of different topographic elevation. And at that break in elevation is a spot called Gale Crater, which is a topographic depression about 150 kilometers in diameter. And within that depression is a great mound of layered strata. And what we can see in the strata is evidence for what was formerly aqueous environments, and we should be able to study effectively a series of time records within the earliest history of Mars and begin to understand its evolution from a very wet planet and possibly habitable to microorganisms to the dry planet that it is today.
So this is quite a small drill, though, so you can only really, metaphorically speaking, scratch the surface of the planet. So how far back in time do you think you'll be able to go?
Well, we know that the crater that contains this thick pile of strata is probably over 4 billion years old. And then using some other evidence that we have available, we suspect that the strata themselves are probably not much younger than 3 billion years. So somewhere between 4 billion and 3 billion years ago, we've got 5 kilometers of sediment that has been piled up to form these layers to look at. And that really represents the principal target that we're after.
What sorts of questions will you be able to answer? How Mars started off, how it evolved, got wet, got dry, and then possibly life?
What we're able to do is take advantage of the fact that these strata have been quite deeply eroded. And so what was once buried is now exposed. We're able to tap right into what would originally have been the sort of the internal part of this mountain of strata. And when you go from the lower to the upper layers, you're basically going from the oldest records of time to the youngest records of time. And where there are sediments, there are records of the environment. And so by drilling and sampling our way up through this pile of strata, we're effectively given the chance to reconstruct not just the state of the environment early on in Mars, but also the way it might have evolved.
But looking at the practicalities for a minute, how do you get almost a ton of rover out there? How long is it going to take to get there? And then how do you get it down onto the surface of Mars once you arrive?
To begin with, we launch, and then on the cruise from Earth to Mars, everything is pretty much the same. There's a solar array which keeps the rover charged. It'll take us about 8 months, and then we begin to feel the pull of the gravitational field, and we enter the planet's atmosphere and begin to descend. But this time, in contrast to previous Mars landed missions, the aeroshell, which is the bit that you see in these videos that sort of screaming along and with flame shooting out beneath it, it's actually able to steer a little bit because we have an ejectable mass, and it offsets the center of mass from the center of symmetry, and it allows it to fly a bit like an airplane wing. And then there are thrusters that are activated to allow it to correct the trajectory. And so instead of sort of plunging vertically through the atmosphere, it's actually coming down at quite a low angle. And then when it decelerates to about Mach 2, it deploys the parachute, and that slows it down even further. And then when we get down to maybe a kilometer above the surface, the heat shield falls away, and from that now everything gets very different from previous missions. We now have a fourth spacecraft called the Powered Descent Vehicle. And the Powered Descent Vehicle has 8 rocket thrusters, and beneath it is attached the rover, pretty much ready to go, with the wheels hanging down. The descent stage then will drop down. The thrusters will push against the gravitational pull of Mars until it hovers maybe 20 meters or so above the surface, and then it reels the rover out on a set of cables down to the surface of the planet, and then there, the descent vehicle detects the change in mass because now the planet is partially supporting the weight of the rover. The cables are cut, and the descent stage goes off and crash lands, And the rover, unlike previous rovers, this one requires very little effort to actually get going. It's pretty much it lands ready to go as a result of that process.
And assuming it all does go according to plan, how long will Curiosity be able to drive around on the surface of the planet?
It's one Mars year, which is a bit longer than two Earth years. But if you compare it to MIR, those were built to go 3 months. So with 2 years, who knows how long we'll be able to go.
NASA's John Grotzinger. And if you'd like to find out a bit more about Curiosity, there is a terrific feature in this month's edition of Chemistry World magazine, which is well worth a read. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, sending messages by bacteria and clothes that change colour according to how much oxygen there is around. But first, we were talking about Teflon earlier. Now we're back for more, and this time to hear how you can stick it to boron. Laura.
A group led by Helga Wilner from the Bergischer University in Wuppertal were looking at trying to make large weakly coordinating anions. So these are very large spherical symmetrical anions that their charge is really sort of spread out. It's not really polarized, so it doesn't interact very much, but it can help stabilize these cations that are quite weak. One of the anions that people have been thinking about for a long time is boron surrounded by Teflon groups, so CF3.
Why would that be good?
Well, it would have all the properties that you'd want. I mean, the CF3 would mean that around it, it's not very polarizable because it's so large and like a big, big ball. So it's sort of, you know, you've got your boron in the middle surrounded by these huge, great big molecules, and there's not really anywhere for the electrons to sort of go.
I sense a but coming.
But, yes. They just couldn't make it. They tried various different ways of doing it, but they often found that it just wasn't going to work because of boron's Lewis acid capabilities. They couldn't. Usually when you make an anion like this, you do ligand substitution. So you put something on and then you take something off and put a different bit on its place.
Very laborious, very inefficient and so on.
Yeah, but boron, it just wasn't working.
What have they done instead?
Instead, they've used these great interhalogen compounds, especially chlorine trifluoride, so ClF3, which it will set fire if it interacts with just about anything. If you mix it with sand, it will set fire. If you mix it with asbestos, it will set fire. If you mix it with yourself, it will set fire. So there's not a lot of labs in the world that want to do anything with this stuff.
I'm not surprised. So what do they do with it?
You have to keep it under very cold conditions, keep it under a very inner atmosphere and just be very, very, very careful with it.
What do you keep it in?
I think they keep it in stainless steel, but I wouldn't like to say for certain. It's been
or
a while.
Or try even. Yes.
No.
So they've managed to make this material safely.
They have managed to make it. They've now got up to sort of 62 grams of the stuff. They've got.
So you have boron. You react it with this chlorine trifluoride.
So actually what you work on is a boron with cyanide groups around it. And instead of substituting onto the boron, what you do instead is you add the fluorine to the carbon and break the CN bonds of your cyanide and replace those with fluorines.
What could they do with it?
Well, at the moment, they've got to see whether it's actually got all the properties that they hope it has. At the moment, it's all just it was a theoretical target and they've got it and this is amazing. They think it's going to be pretty good. What they'd like to use it for are for ionic liquids, but obviously you need to have a good pairing and so this can help with that.
Why are ionic liquids important though? What can we do with them?
They're made by, you know, by two ions, and a cation and an anion. They're a way of doing chemistry often without other solvents. So it can make things without all the nasty sort of organic solvents that often we try and avoid.
Well, from the nastiest chemical known to man to perhaps becoming one of the most useful, onto something else potentially nefarious, but also with good intentions to bacteria that could send secret messages.
Well, yes, Chris, next time you get a spam message, maybe you should read it. At least that's if it's the kind of spam that David Walt at Tufts University in Massachusetts is talking about.
What, Viagra offers mortgages and shares of a dead dictator in Nigeria's fortune?
Not quite, Chris. It's steganography by printed arrays of microbes, steganography being the encoding of secret messages.
And spam for short, hence
Indeed.
The acronym. Okay, so
Indeed.
What have they actually done?
The idea is that you take engineered strains of E. coli that are made to be fluorescent. they've taken seven different strains, which fluoresce in seven different colours. If you combine two of those together to make a sort of bit of information, that gives you 49 different combinations, which is plenty to do all of the letters of the alphabet, the numbers, bit of punctuation and bits and bobs. You can then kind of put strings of those pairs together to make a message. So if, for example, you put an orange strain with a green one, that's an I, and a yellow one with a red one, that's an R. And what this team did was put enough of those together to spell out the message. This is a bio-encoded message from the Walt Lab at Tufts University 2011.
How do you read it?
Well, the idea of transmitting the message is that the person who wants to send the message grows up the bacteria in a little multi-well plate or something like that. You can then get a sheet of paper or nitrocellulose or something like that, press it onto the surface, which transfers some of the bacteria, shove that in a post. The other person at the other end gets the sheet of cellulose, puts that into some growth medium, grows up the colonies of bacteria, and they start fluorescing, and you can then read out the pairs of colours and get your message.
So what's the security side to this, though?
OK, well, first of all, you need to know that there's a message on the paper. It's pretty much invisible until you start growing the bacteria. But if you know that, then you can add a second layer of cipher by using antibiotics. So instead of in each well just having one form of bacteria, you can have two different strains that fluoresce different colours and are resistant to different antibiotics. So you then need to treat the whole thing with the right antibiotic to get the message. And the group did that, so they encoded a message that if you treat it with ampicillin, you get the same message that I said before about it being a bio-encoded message from the Walt Lab at Tufts. But if you use kanamycin, which is a different antibiotic, you get the message that says, you have used the wrong cipher and this message is gibberish. And if you use a non-selective antibiotic, then you just get a complete load of guff anyway.
Exactly. What do they say it could be used for, though?
Well, for the first thing, you've got to rely on some kind of postal service, which introduces a bit of a weak link, especially if you're talking about the Royal Mail. It's kind of an experiment in a concept of sending messages. But there are ways that you can improve it even further. David Walt's talking about having bacteria that change the way they fluoresce over time, so you could have a message that would automatically self-destruct. So if your message is not particularly urgent, but you really need it to be secure, perhaps that's a possible application.
Puts a whole new spin on the idea of a message going viral. Thank you, Phil. Last month was Nobel time again, and the chemistry prize this year went to the Israeli scientist Danny Schechtman for his discovery of the concept of quasicrystals. But it wasn't all plain sailing for Schechtman beforehand. He endured a very rough ride when he first announced his findings in the 1980s, including a scathing put-down from the chemist Linus Pauling, who described the work as nonsense, remarking, "There is no such thing as quasicrystals, only quasi-scientists." Well, that got proved wrong, but if, like me, you only have a quasi-understanding of what a quasi-crystal is, then maybe physicist Hans-Reiner Trebin from Stuttgart University can help.
Crystals are composed of atoms in such a way that the structure repeats periodically. This is like a wallpaper where you have a certain decoration, and this repeats to the left and right and up and down. In a crystal, you have this periodic pattern in three directions. So if you know what the basic pattern is, you know what the crystal is looking at infinite distances. Now, there is a certain restriction on the symmetry of periodic systems. You can rotate a square crystal, for example, by 90 degrees. This is called a fourfold rotation, because 90 degrees is 360 degrees over four. You can rotate the periodic crystal also by 60 degrees. So one has certain rotation symmetries, which means you rotate them and they look alike after the rotation. And for periodic systems, this rotation is twofold, threefold, fourfold, and sixfold, and nothing else. Schechtman discovered now a crystal which has fivefold symmetry. The question is, what kind of structure is it? It cannot be periodic.
Indeed, and obviously when he saw that and then tried to tell people about it,
everyone would have said, look, we've known about crystals for 120 years. This cannot exist.
Yeah. Nobody believed that such a structure is possible, in particular since it showed certain features in electron microscopy, certain reflections, which had also fivefold symmetry. So the question is something ordered and not periodic. This one could not imagine what it be.
What was the material he was actually looking at when he made this discovery?
Well, he was looking for lightweighted materials, which you can use in aeronautics. This was aluminum alloys. It was aluminum manganese and later also aluminum iron.
So once he had begun to explore how this could happen, how did he discover actually what was going on, that there must be this fivefold symmetry which totally broke the mould as far as crystal architectures had been before?
Well, there was some discussion by theoreticians at this time about this fivefold symmetry. In particular, there was this pattern which your British mathematician and physicist Penrose had proposed 10 years prior. This so-called Penrose pattern. It consists of two types of rhombohedra, which you have to put aside according to certain rules, and which has a fivefold symmetry, and which is not periodic. So this pattern one was looking at, and the proposal was that the structure of this aluminum manganese is following the Penrose pattern.
So how did they then take that forward to ask, okay, we've got a mathematical theory, but translating that to something which you can physically see in a chemical is a different matter. So how did they do that?
Well, that's the interesting thing, that things which mathematicians have thought appear always in nature. This is a rule, a very, very nice rule. One could extend this Penrose pattern to three dimensions. The explanation was you take, you tile now space, three-dimensional space, not with two types of rhombs, but with two types of rhombohedra. And then you get the symmetry, which also Schechtmann discovered, which is an icosahedral symmetry. It was like a three-dimensional Penrose pattern. Of course, you took these rhombohedra, and one had to put atoms in a certain way at special places of these rhombohedra. This one could do, and one had an approximate structure for this aluminum manganese quasicrystal.
But what's the really important thing here? The fact that we've proved that this can exist, it does exist, and it's borne out by both mathematical and observational models. But chemically speaking, why is it important? How does it change the lives of everyone on the planet?
The structure is determining also the properties of physical subjects. Structure is as important as the elements. You had metallic elements, but the structure then induced non-metallic properties. For example, a metal has a low resistance for electric current. These quasicrystals have a high resistance. A metal can be easily be bent. These quasicrystals are very hard and brittle. So you have non-metallic properties induced in a structure of metallic atoms. And so you now can play around with matter and induce now properties which you can use in industry, for example, or in applications.
Are they very easy to initiate if you want to give a quasicrystal architecture with this fivefold symmetry to a material which would normally not form that particular organization? Can you inflict that configuration upon it?
Well, one has now investigated very closely the electronic properties of these quasicrystals. And there are certain rules for which are valid for quasicrystals. And these rules have been applied in particular by Japanese material scientists. And following these rules, they could synthesize, hundreds of new substances. These rules are somehow easy to express. You have to have a certain number of electrons which participate in the construction of these solids. The number of valence electrons per atom must follow certain numbers. And once you know that, you might be able to synthesize a quasicrystal.
Hans-Reiner Trebin from Stuttgart University. And now to a colourful line of chemical research. Laura.
Yes, this is about chameleon clothes. This is talking about using a smart material to tell you when you're in an area with low oxygen levels.
I've been to plenty of pubs which have a terrible lack of atmosphere. Never been that deprived of oxygen, though. Why would this be useful?
Well, you know, in your everyday life, you might not have that many reasons to worry about the oxygen levels, but there are certain jobs where this would be a problem. For example, mining. So Ji Chen from Ziman University in China, who's the person who's done this work, was actually inspired by seeing these coal miners getting trapped underground and having problems with lack of oxygen. And that's actually what inspired him to do this work.
How does it work?
They basically take just a normal thread of cotton. Into that, they sort of encapsulate these polystyrene microparticles. So small, very small balls of polystyrene, not quite like you have in your bean bag, but a bit smaller than that. And then attached to that are two dyes. There is a blue dye and a red dye. The blue dye is like a reference dye that stays giving the same amount of blue. The red dye is reactive to the amount of oxygen. So if there's an equal, you know, if there's a decent amount of oxygen in the atmosphere, you're going to get a purple colour. If the oxygen level dies down, then the red colour dies down, and then you get a change to a more blue colour.
And so that's the visual readout.
So that's the visual readout, but there's actually more. So that's your sort of qualitative, oh, look, there's a problem. Because of the dyes that have been chosen, you can actually also get a quantitative readout if you use a digital camera, because the two dyes are chosen because they match up with the sensors in your digital camera. So if you have one and you can take a snapshot, you can actually read the colour and get a percentage of where the oxygen level is.
Is it linear? In other words, do we know what colour you get in proportion to
yes.
what amount of oxygen? So you can literally almost
you
read
can
it
literally
off
sort
like
of read it off as a sort of a percentage. Yeah.
And so, would you actually wear this, or would it be better to have some kind of badge or something? Maybe?
Yeah, I mean, possibly it would be better to have a badge. I mean, they're talking about maybe sort of doing some sort of embroidery into your uniform, so you wouldn't be wearing a whole outfit that would change colour as you dance around, though.
Are we far away from fabricating this? Is it?
I think fabrication is completely doable. People have outfits with microencapsulation in already. I think more the issue is, in a way, there's a solution to maybe a question that wasn't necessarily being asked.
Yet. But another ingenious and very simple solution to a problem. But again, I can't believe that no one thought of it before. Thank you, Laura. Now, Patrick, let's go from outside the body to inside the body. And this is an interesting story about patching up people's hearts.
Patching up their hearts with a heart of gold. So people who suffer heart damage, the best thing to do would be to try and replace that tissue with some undamaged tissue. Currently, people have been trying to grow up things like cardiac myocytes in scaffolds, but the problem is these myocytes don't communicate very well with each other. So what Daniel Cohane at Harvard Medical School has done is he's tried to connect them up properly. So just like an electrician would go around your house and he would connect everything up back to one fuse box, that's what he's trying to do with these cells.
Oh, I see. So in the heart, where we rely on a coordinated beating in the right sequence of cells, each cell in turn contracting in order to make a coordinated contraction of the heart, if you just have random cells being put into a previously damaged bit of the heart and they're not connected up, you won't get that useful connected synchronous behaviour. And you're saying maybe we could come up with a way of actually physically connecting the cells together in order to achieve that.
Exactly, yes. So often they use scaffolds, things like alginates, which are extracted from seaweed. So you can build up these 3D scaffolds and build up nice sort of structures of cells that are quite thick and would be good for filling in for damaged tissue. But the problem with these alginate scaffolds is that the cells won't talk to each other because they get stuck in these pores and then they can't communicate across the pore walls. So what this group did was, when they were formulating the alginate scaffolds, they dumped a whole load of gold nanorods, nanowires, into the alginates. So these are about a micron long and the walls of the actual scaffold are about 500 nanometers thick. So lots of these nanowires would have penetrated the walls.
So it's like a pre-made wiring loom.
Exactly.
In contact with all the cells.
Yeah, yeah. So all the cells are basically in contact with the others through these gold nanowires.
Does it work?
Yeah, I mean, they did some tests and what they found was when you stimulate these myocytes, you get propagation of electrical signals in an organised manner across the whole patch. So they'll start at one end and then they'll gradually move across, contracting as they go.
But how do you know, though, that it's not just the stimulus that you've put in to excite one of the cells just going down the wires and then recruiting all the cells on the way? Is it actually physically the cells transmitting their own currents along the wires to each other?
OK, so all the wires aren't all linked up. They're kind of randomly dropped into the scaffold. So if you stimulate it at one end, it shouldn't just be going along the wires, although you never know. But I think the researchers have already looked into that.
So basically, it's got to be that a cell goes off, it gets excited, and then the current from that cell passes down the wire to the next cell.
Yeah.
So this is in vitro, though, isn't it? So they haven't actually taken those patches with the nanowires and put them in vivo yet.
Yep, that's right. So they're still just working with cell cultures, really. They're just working with the cultures in scaffolds. So the next thing is to move on to trying to put it into animals. I mean, Daniel Cohen himself says it's still a bit of a way off from actually getting into people. So he still thinks it's quite a few years away from that.
And just on the subject of gold, is it OK to put things like gold nanorods into people? Are they biocompatible?
They say that is one of the advantages of things like gold nanoparticles, gold nanowires, that they can be functionalised to actually make them non-toxic. So you would end up with a heart of gold, but your heart would be fixed.
Unlike Patrick's poor puns, which are nearly as bad as mine. But stay there, Patrick, because it says here you want to talk about Mole Day.
Right, so do you know what's special about the 23rd of October?
No. Well, obviously Halloween is the 31st, but I guess that's not relevant. So no, I don't know. What's special about the 23rd of the 10th?
Well, chemists were celebrating it between 6.02am and 6.02pm, which might give you a clue.
6.02. Well, it's sort of got the beginnings of Avogadro's number
exactly,
there.
Exactly, yes.
Is that
so
relevant?
6.02 a.m. times 10th month,
10 to the power 23,
October 23rd. So
it's
there
the
you
Avogadro
go.
Number. Okay, right.
So this obviously works a bit better if you're in the US because the month comes before the date, but it is principally celebrated in the US. So it's all about trying to raise the profile of chemistry and get students interested in it.
Okay, so what will you be doing for Mole Day, then?
I think as many cheesy jokes as possible about moles could work.
Okay, I've got one. What do you call a tooth in a glass of water?
I don't know. What do you call a tooth in a glass of water?
I can barely bring myself to this because I'm going to eclipse you. It's a one molar solution.
Of course it is.
No, but seriously, tell us a little bit about Avogadro and why this Mole Day is important.
OK, so Avogadro was the guy who worked out the number of atoms you would have in 12 grams of carbon-12. So this is a way chemists can work out how much of a reactant they're using in a chemical reaction. So, for instance, water has an atomic mass of 18, so 16 for oxygen and 2 for the two hydrogens. So if you had 18 grams of water, you'd know that's one mole. So it's a way to simply know how much you have got of a substance. The whole idea of Mole Day, it came out back in the 80s, but didn't really gain any traction till a bit later on, perhaps the 90s, when school teachers across the US started trying to promote Mole Day as a way to raise the profile of chemistry, get kids interested, and also to just let people know all about Avogadro and the idea behind moles. I mean, it's all GCSE chemistry.
And that's where we must leave it for this month. Thank you to Phil Broadwith, Laura Howes and Patrick Walter, and our guests John Grotzinger and Hans-Reiner Trebeen. Production this month was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. There's more cutting-edge chemistry next month, but until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.